What if the secret to a lifelong love of your sport wasn't just in how you train your body? What joy, possibility, and performance could be unlocked through the power of mental fitness? Well, you're about to find out. Welcome to the MindFit Athlete Podcast. If you want to figure out what's holding you back, then you're in the right place. Now, here's your host, John Ray.
Hello, team, and welcome to the MindFit Athlete Podcast. This is the podcast exploring the intersection of endurance sport and the science of a flourishing life. I'm John.
I'm Scott.
And I'm Emily.
In these podcasts, we hope to inspire busy people, people just like you, to weave the core sports of triathlon into a life that's not just healthier, but happier and more fulfilled, okay? So Emily and Scott, we often start these conversations by talking about a race or a training principle. But today, I want to start somewhere a little different. We've recently had the news of the tragic shooting of the American conservative commentator Charlie Kirk. And I heard an audio clip from where he said something that, I must admit, stopped me in my tracks. Emily, you will be much closer to this than me. And actually, I didn't really know much about Charlie Kirk. But with your permission, I'd like to read it.
Go for it, John. I'm intrigued.
He said, and I quote, I can't stand empathy, actually. I think empathy is a made-up New Age term that does a lot of damage, but it is very effective when it comes to politics. Sympathy, I prefer more than empathy.
Wow. Okay, that's quite a statement.
It sure is. Now, I don't want to stray into the politics of Charlie Kirk, and of course I abhor his shooting. Whatever your politics, you have to say that in our modern world, Charlie Kirk was a hugely successful communicator, and it's obvious that he's been highly influential and has had friends in very high places. The quote, though, was really interesting. For a start, he's absolutely right about the made-up word. The word empathy did not come directly into use from ancient Greek, but it certainly isn't New Age. The word empathy was coined in 1909 by the British psychologist Edward Titchener as a translation of a German word meaning feeling into. Titchener deliberately used the Greek roots to create a new English term for this specific psychological concept of projecting one's own feelings into an object or another person. And that got me thinking about those two words, sympathy and empathy. We often use them almost interchangeably, but are they the same? And is one really preferable to the other?
Oh, they are so, so different, and I have to be straight up on this. For me, there is just no way, I mean no way, that sympathy is better. I think Charlie Kirk could not have been more wrong on that. I think of it like this. Imagine you come across a road accident. The car is on its side and someone is clearly injured. If you have only sympathy, you sit in your car. You look over and you feel that pit in your stomach. You think, oh, that poor person, how terrible. You feel their pain, but you are completely paralyzed by it. You're stuck in inaction.
Right, you're a spectator to the tragedy, almost like you're viewing it on TV, detached from a distance. And that's what's so interesting about the root of the word sympathy. It really was an ancient Greek word and has been in the English language for more than 400 years, but it means feels with. In other words, you are as one with the person in the accident. You feel their pain, and with that feeling, you experience the same distress and powerlessness.
Exactly. Sympathy means you are affected by their situation. You see their pain and distress, and it triggers your own feelings of sadness, pity, and concern. If you feel their powerlessness too deeply, you can become overwhelmed by your own emotions, making it harder to act effectively. But if you have empathy, you feel that same initial connection, but then you immediately ask, what's needed here? You put yourself in their shoes and you realize what they need most isn't someone feeling sad for them. What they need is an ambulance. So you pick up the phone and you call for help. That's the difference. One is passive feeling, the other is compassionate action.
Emily, that is a brilliant way to frame it. You've just described, almost perfectly, the difference between a brain hijacked by its survival instincts and a brain operating from its calm, clear-headed center. It seems to me you've defined empathy as a two-step process. Heart, which is the emotional connection, plus mind, which is the clear-headed question. What's needed?
So sympathy is just the heart part without the mind kicking in?
Precisely. In the positive intelligence framework, we call that a saboteur hijack.
That's really counterintuitive. You're suggesting that sympathy is somehow associated with a more negative mindset?
Yes, but hear me out. There's a very specific cue happening here. In sympathy, there is an initial feeling of compassion towards the injured person in Emily's accident. That compassion is definitely sage, the part of you that cares. I think that's the aspect of sympathy that we focus on, which makes it feel valuable and positive. But then in the sympathy-only response, your saboteurs rush in, instantly taking over. The compassion is replaced. The telltale cue here is that we make it all about me. Your victim saboteur might scream, "Oh, this is awful. I feel so overwhelmed, there's nothing I can do." And that leads to that emotional paralysis Emily described.
Or you just want to get away from it, escape the scene.
That's your avoider saboteur saying, "This is too messy. I don't want to get involved." The result is the same. You're trapped in the negative, distressing emotion, and you take no helpful action.
So true empathy in this model is when the mind part comes online to guide the heart.
Yes, but it's more than just two steps. It's a seamless activation of all five of our sage powers, our positive mental muscles. It starts with empathize. That's the heart connection. You feel compassion for the injured person. But then almost instantly, you use self-command. This is the crucial pause. It's the mental muscle we build with PQ reps, those little mindfulness exercises. It's the moment of calm that stops the saboteurs from hijacking you and allows your clear mind to engage.
That precious space between stimulus and response.
Exactly. And in that space, you explore. You get curious. You ask, what's most important here? You gather facts instead of being overwhelmed by drama. Is the car on fire? Is anyone else helping? Are other vehicles going to be at risk? Notice what's different here. It's not about you, it's about others. Then you innovate and navigate. You brainstorm options. I can call 999. I can check my first aid kit. I can wave down other cars. And finally, you activate. You take that decisive, laser-focused action. You ask yourself Emily's question. What's needed right now? Or what's the most useful action I can take? You call the ambulance. It's an action born from calm assessment, not panic.
And you see this in sport all the time. Imagine your training partner starts to bonk during a long ride. The sympathy response is, "Oh, that feels terrible. I hate it when that happens. You must feel horrible. This is a disaster. Our whole day is ruined. I feel so bad for you." You both get anxious and frustrated, and your performance suffers. You're stuck in their problem. The empathy response is different. You feel compassion for their struggle. You stay calm. You get curious. What do they need right now? You realize you have a spare gel. You say, "Hey, let's ease up. Sit on my wheel, take this gel, and let's get you home." With empathy, you've moved from being a paralyzed spectator of the problem to an active part of the solution.
You know, this conversation makes it impossible not to think of the work of Dr. Brené Brown. She has done so much to bring these ideas into the mainstream.
She's the one who talks about vulnerability, right?
She is, and her work on empathy is foundational. Now, I know I'm at risk of this being confusing, but I think I'll take the chance. Brené offers her own functional definition of sympathy and empathy that actually challenges the classical meaning of the words. She frames the difference as sympathy being feeling for people, while empathy is feeling with them. She then goes on to argue that sympathy generates disconnection, while only empathy builds connection. From a strict linguistic point of view, you could argue she has it backwards. For Brené Brown, empathy isn't about passive co-suffering. It's about active solidarity. It means choosing to be present with someone in their struggle. It means you communicate, "I am here with you. You are not alone."
I love that. So by defining empathy as feeling with, she's taking the phrase and elevating it from a passive state to a conscious connecting choice.
Precisely. It becomes the bedrock of true connection, not disconnection. Here's her famous analogy for this. Imagine seeing someone stuck in a deep, dark hole. Sympathy is standing at the top of the hole, looking down and shouting, "Oh, poor you. It's bad down there, huh? How about a sandwich? Would that help?" You're acknowledging their pain from a safe distance. It's all distant pity. You might even try to silver line it. Well, at least you didn't break a bone. Notice how this is a way to keep yourself separate from their messy struggle. It's helping you, not helping them.
Just as we said earlier, sympathy is more about me than you. Whereas with empathy, Well, you have to get your hands dirty?
Yes. Empathy is the brave choice to climb down into the hole with them, look around and say, I know what it's like down here and you're not alone. It's a courageous act. It requires vulnerability, because you have to touch a piece of that same pain within yourself to connect with the other person. You're simply communicating that profound message. You are not alone.
And that is everything. For me, that is true leadership. Think about a teammate who misses the winning shot or has a terrible race. The sympathy response is the platitude from the top of the hole. Ah, tough luck. You'll get him next time. I'm sure you have had that said to you. Just how did it feel? If you are anything like me, you'll get them next time is shallow, empty, and it creates distance between us. It makes me feel even more isolated in my disappointment.
So what would be the empathy response?
You walk over, you sit next to them, and maybe you say nothing for a minute. Then you just say, that's a tough one. I'm gutted for you. Notice that for Brené, empathy is not in a rush to fix things. It's spacious and always non-judgmental. You are simply climbing into that hole of disappointment with them. That builds unbreakable bonds.
And some of you might think of this as passive, but it's not. It's very conscious. It's deliberate. It's mindful, and it's heart and brain working together. You are still thinking, what's needed here? But in this case, what's needed is space.
So let's explore a real-world application of empathy as we discussed it so far. Just how should a coach handle that critical moment right after an athlete has poured their heart out on the course?
John, that is the most important moment in the entire coaching relationship. And the common instinct, to immediately analyze, is the absolute worst thing you can do. There's a framework which is used by top psychologists at places like British Triathlon that I've always followed instinctively. It's a three-phase process, and the rule for that first phase in the hours right after the finish line is simple. Connection, not correction. The athlete is in a volatile hormonal and emotional state. Euphoria, devastation, it's all there. My job is to be a calm, supportive presence and nothing more. I'm there to listen, not to talk.
So you're not giving any feedback at all. My instinct would be to say something quite specific, like, did you see your swim time? That was stunning.
Nope. Any attempt at analysis, positive or negative, will be filtered through that raw emotional lens and it won't land. It can even feel invalidating. The only thing to say is, that was an incredible effort. I am so proud of you. Whatever you're feeling is okay. You have to show them you care about the person first, their performance second.
Emily, what you're describing is pure Brené Brown. That is the literal act of climbing into that messy, emotional hole with the athlete, instead of shouting analysis from the top. It's the ultimate act of connection.
That's exactly it. Because only after you've made that connection can you move to phase two, which happens a day or two later. That's when you have the first conversation. The goal here is just to gather their story. I'll use open-ended questions like, when you're ready, I'd love to hear how the day unfolded for you. I'm just an active listener, taking notes on their experience. The stomach issues, the negative self-talk, the unexpected energy surge. Those are the golden nuggets.
So at this stage, you're capturing their subjective truth before you bring in any of the objective data.
Precisely, because that data means nothing without their story. Which brings us to phase three, about a week later, when the emotional dust has settled. This is the true analytical debrief. Now we sit down together with the power files, the heart rate data, the splits, and we weave it into the story they told me. I can say, you mentioned feeling flat on the bike here, and I see in the data your heart rate was dropping. Let's explore that. We identify the key learnings together, and then, most importantly, we close the book on that race and start looking forward.
It's a perfect sage-powered process. You start with pure empathize at the finish line. Then you explore their story. And only then, once that foundation of trust is solid, can you effectively innovate and activate a plan for the future. You absolutely cannot skip the first steps.
You can't, because when you follow that process, you build unbreakable trust, and you ensure that every single race, no matter the result, becomes a powerful lesson that makes you a stronger, smarter athlete. Nothing is ever wasted.
So, given all of what we've discussed, I just cannot see how Charlie Kirk could possibly have concluded that sympathy is preferable to empathy. I'm really at a loss. Let me bring up a fascinating dynamic of all this in coaching. A coach can't just climb into the hole and endlessly stay there with the athlete, can they? There has to be some point where what's needed next is a movement forward.
John, you've just hit on the most critical distinction in effective coaching. You're absolutely right. So often, a new client comes to me with a painful story. I always choke under pressure, or I'm just not mentally tough enough. And they believe that story. It feels 100% true to them. A coach who practices sympathy, who stays in the hole, essentially believes the story too. They co-collude with the athlete's saboteurs. They say, "You're right, it's so tough, the pressure is just too much." And all that does is reinforce the negative pattern. They both get stuck in the hole.
They're validating the saboteur's script.
Exactly. But a great coach, someone like Steve Chandler, taught me to make a pivot. He would actively listen, acknowledge, clarify, and then he would ask the most powerful question. Given that this is where we find ourselves, what do you want to create?
That's a beautiful shift.
It's everything. That one question bypasses the entire drama of the saboteur story. It accepts the present moment without judgment. This is where we find ourselves. And immediately focuses the brain on the future, on creation, on possibility. It presumes the athlete is powerful and at choice, not a victim of their story.
And from a PQ perspective, that question is pure sage. It starts by accepting the what is, and then immediately engages navigate or innovate. It's a masterful redirect from the problem-focused survival brain to a purpose-linked and creative sage brain.
Yes, and the founder of the Life Coach School, Brooke Castillo, uses the perfect analogy. She imagines her client is struggling in a swimming pool, panicking, surrounded by alligators or piranhas or whatever. A well-meaning friend practicing sympathy will jump into the pool with them,
while the effective coach applying empathy stays on the deck.
Right, John. The coach is the lifeguard on the deck. They stay poolside, holding a higher, calmer perspective. They don't see a helpless victim. They see a person who is naturally creative, resourceful, and whole, who has just momentarily forgotten how to swim. Their job is to remind the swimmer of their own power.
So the lifeguard doesn't ignore the struggle. They have to connect first.
That's the crucial first step. The masterful coaching sequence is, first, you empathize. You climb into the hole for just a moment to say, "I see you, you're not alone." You might say, "I hear you, that sounds incredibly frustrating." You validate the feeling, but not the saboteur story. Then once that connection is made, you pivot. You stay on the deck and ask that Steve Chandler question, "I get that it feels that way. And, given this situation, what do you want to create?" You honor the person's feeling without buying into their limiting story. That's the move that shifts someone from being a prisoner of their past to the author of their future.
So let's circle back to where we started. I'm going to reread this quote from Charlie Kirk again, now that we have this deeper understanding. I can't stand empathy, actually. I think empathy is a made-up New Age term that does a lot of damage. Sympathy, I prefer more than empathy.
Hearing it now, it's just so sad. It's a worldview built on a foundation of fear. From our conversation today, it's clear. Sympathy is shallow. It's self-oriented. It's about me not wanting to feel your messy feelings. It's fear-based. Empathy is deeper. It's connecting. It's outward-reaching. It is, at its core, an act of love.
And Emily, I'd further add that Scott's inclusion of Brené Brown's work suggests that sympathy actually promotes separation, while empathy creates the conditions of connection. I mean, who would seriously offer that our world needs even more separation? He's obviously an intelligent and capable man, so I wonder if his justification is that empathy is so powerful it can be used to manipulate people, particularly in politics. I mean, in that respect, he's got a point, hasn't he?
No, I don't think so. For me, there's a fundamental flaw in his logic. He is confusing genuine empathy with its counterfeit version.
True empathy is a sage power. Its goal is pure understanding and connection. What he's describing, using the language of connection for personal gain, isn't empathy at all.
Right, that's manipulation, plain and simple. In fact, it's a saboteur tactic. A hyperachiever or controller saboteur might mimic the language of empathy to win a vote or close a deal. But the moment the other person is no longer useful, the fake empathy vanishes.
So it's as if Mr. Kirk is seeing counterfeit money, and from that observation he's declaring all currency to be worthless?
Exactly, and with that lens, his entire statement becomes a perfect expression of a saboteur-driven mindset. When he says, "I can't stand empathy," that suggests to me the raw voices of his controller and avoider saboteurs. They are terrified of the vulnerability Brené Brown talks about. They see someone in that dark hole of messy, unpredictable emotion, and their primary instinct is to stay safely at the top, not to climb down. They fear losing control and getting trapped in that vulnerability, then calling it a made-up New Age term that does damage. That's a classic tactic of the judge saboteur. It dismisses and belittles a concept it finds threatening to invalidate it. And finally, his preference for sympathy. That is the saboteur's choice every single time. It's the safe, distant, self-protective act of shouting a few platitudes from the top of the hole before walking away. It allows for the appearance of caring, without any of the perceived risk of genuine connection.
It makes me think of something the author Stephen Covey wrote. He said that love is a verb. It isn't just a passive feeling that happens to you. It's an active choice. It's something you do. Love takes action. It moves things forward. And when I listen to our conversation, that's exactly what we're saying empathy is. It's love as a verb. It feels a genuine connection, refuses to be diminished by the situation, and then it asks, what action is needed here?
Whereas sympathy, it's just the feeling without the action that follows.
Exactly. It's passive. It's a state of being, not an act of doing.
That's a powerful way to frame it. So sympathy is being a spectator to someone's struggle, while empathy is choosing to be a participant in their solution.
And that is the fundamental difference between a life run by your saboteurs and a life led by your sage. The saboteurs are passive spectators, trapped in the drama of negative feelings. The sage is the active participant. It takes that initial feeling of connection, that love, and uses it to fuel wise and decisive action.
This seems a perfect time for our intermission. This is a little more reflective than usual, but it still manages to be 188 beats per minute. So if you are running or cycling, and it's safe to do so, you can dial in your cadence. We will be right back in just a little under 3 minutes.
Thank you.
Welcome back, everyone. Maybe I was caught by this quote, as it seems that empathy is central to the positive intelligence mental fitness model. It seems to be the starting point for everything.
It is the master key, John. In the positive intelligence framework, empathy is the foundational sage power. It's the gateway. For me, I would find it hard to access the other four sage powers: explore, innovate, navigate, and activate, without first generating the calm, positive emotional state that empathy for self provides. Specifically, it's the essential tool for quieting your primary saboteur, the judge. The judge thrives on criticizing yourself, others, and your circumstances. Empathy is its kryptonite.
And for an athlete, that judge is relentless. It's the voice criticizing poor food choices, a slow split time, a missed workout, or a bad race result. Dialing down the judge is why empathy has to start with yourself. Self-empathy is the critical first step.
Okay, can we please pause there? Because I think we've just walked right up to the elephant in the room.
Okay, is it a big one?
Yes, that big one. Empathy for a struggling teammate, for an injured person on the road. I get it. It's noble. It feels right. But empathy for self. Emily, I have to be honest. A lifetime of British upbringing and my own inner wiring immediately screams, that's dangerously self-indulgent. Maybe there's an element of that in Charlie Kirk's objection. It feels soft. It sounds like making excuses or letting yourself off the hook. And I know I'm not alone in feeling that.
John, I am so incredibly glad you said that out loud, because that is the number one lie the saboteurs tell every single high-performing athlete I have ever coached, and I've told it to myself a million times. We have to be crystal clear about the difference here, because it's everything. Indulgence is getting a flat tire 10 miles into the bike leg of your A race. You fix it, but you spend the next 46 miles brooding, feeling sorry for yourself, telling yourself a story about how your day is ruined and how unlucky you are. That's your victim saboteur having a pity party on wheels. That is useless.
That's wallowing.
That is wallowing. And it kills your performance. Now, self-empathy is completely different. It's getting that same flat tire, and in that moment on the side of the road, you allow yourself to feel the gut punch of frustration. You say to yourself, "This is infuriating and I am so disappointed." You give yourself 60 seconds of grace to feel the feeling, because it's real. But then, because you aren't wasting all your precious mental energy beating yourself up, your mind is clear enough to ask the powerful, game-changing question, okay, what can I do from this exact moment forward to have the best possible race? You get back in the game faster, stronger, and with more focus than the person who is still telling themselves the sad story.
And John, your reaction is so common because our judge saboteur is incredibly deceptive. It has convinced us that the harsh, critical voice is our high-performance coach. But the science is unequivocal on this. Beating yourself up floods your system with cortisol. It puts your brain and body into a threat state. And in that state, you can't access the creative, strategic parts of your mind. You literally can't solve problems well. You play small.
So the self-criticism actually prevents the very improvement it's supposedly trying to create.
Precisely, this is the oxygen mask on first principle applied to mental performance. A brain at war with itself is an oxygen-deprived brain. Practicing self-compassion is like putting on the mask. It calms your nervous system, brings your clear-thinking sage brain online, and allows you to be objective and resourceful. It's not about letting yourself off the hook. It's about giving yourself the actual tools to fix the bike and get back in the race.
Yes, you are more used to yourself and therefore to others when you're not in an internal fight. Indulgence has you quit the race mentally. Self-empathy has you rebound, learn, and sometimes finish stronger and prouder than you ever thought possible. You cannot play full out if you're using half your energy to defeat yourself.
Far too many of us, especially high achievers, have this deeply flawed belief that being hard on ourselves is what motivates us. That shame is a good fuel for improvement, sir.
The no pain, no gain philosophy applied to our inner world?
Precisely, but it's a lie. Stress hormones, like cortisol, actually shut down the creative, problem-solving parts of your brain. Shame doesn't motivate, it paralyzes.
It triggers your other saboteurs. The victim gives up. The avoider procrastinates. You get stuck in a cycle of feeling bad about feeling bad. I always tell my athletes, when you've had a setback, when you're hurting, that is not the time for more punishment. That is the time for active recovery. If you sprain your ankle, you don't stand there screaming at it and try to keep running. You stop. You give it care so it can heal and you can come back stronger. Self-compassion is the mental and emotional equivalent of that.
So is there a difference between self-compassion and self-empathy?
That's a great question. They are deeply connected. The way to think about it is that self-compassion is the practice and self-empathy is the result. Self-compassion is the active, intentional work. It's doing the reps. Every time you catch your judge saboteur beating you up and you consciously choose to be kind to yourself instead, that is a rep of self-compassion.
It's the training.
Right, and self-empathy is the resulting strength. It's the developed skill of being able to sit with your own difficult emotions, disappointment, frustration, sadness, with a calm, non-judgmental presence.
It's like building your aerobic base. You don't just go out and run a marathon. You do the consistent, daily runs. That's the practice of self-compassion. The resulting ability to hold a strong pace for 26.2 miles is your aerobic capacity. That's your self-empathy. You can't have one without the other.
So if this is a skill, a muscle we can build, is there a how-to guide?
There is. The researcher Kristin Neff has done foundational work in this area. She breaks self-compassion down into three concrete, actionable pillars. The first is self-kindness versus self-judgment. This is the obvious one. It's the conscious choice to be warm and understanding with yourself when you fail, instead of berating yourself. The second is common humanity versus isolation. This is the crucial step of recognizing that suffering and failure are part of the shared human experience. It directly counters that victim saboteur, feeling that this only happens to me. And the third is mindfulness versus over-identification. This is the practice of observing your negative thoughts and emotions with a balanced perspective, without getting swept away by them. In our terms, it's noticing your saboteurs are active without getting hijacked.
Let's make that real for an athlete. You just finished a half marathon and missed your goal time by 5 minutes. You feel that wave of disappointment. The old way is to let the judge take over. I'm a failure. I didn't train hard enough. The new way, using Neff's model, would be first, mindfulness. You pause, you notice the feeling. Okay, this is disappointment. I feel it in my stomach. My thoughts are negative. I'm just going to observe this. Second, common humanity. You connect your experience to others. Every runner I admire has had bad races. This is a normal part of the sport. This feeling is universal for anyone who sets big goals. The isolation just dissolves. And third, self-kindness. You actively soothe yourself. You might even physically put a hand on your heart and say what you'd say to a friend. That was a really tough race. It's okay to be disappointed. You put in a huge effort and I'm proud of you for finishing.
And by following those three steps, you actively process the setback. You turn a damaging saboteur moment into a resilient, sage-led experience.
I should say that there is a very sound neurochemical basis for Kirsten's use of physicality in self-compassion, and you can find out more about oxytocin if you search back a few episodes. Before we close, I want to go back to my own reaction to that Charlie Kirk quote. I'll admit it really triggered me, and I knew nothing else about the man, but these few words alone sparked a very strong negative response. Why is that? And what would a PQ-aligned approach have been in that moment?
That's a great question, John. Your strong reaction was likely because the quote represented a profound values clash. It's clear from our chat that we all see empathy as a core value for connection and kindness. Mr. Kirk's statement was a direct assault on that value. Instantly, that activates your own judge saboteur, whose job is to spot what is wrong in any situation. That's what a trigger is, a saboteur hijacking.
So if I had been there, face to face with him, what might I have done?
I'd offer that if you were speaking to Mr. Kirk, you wouldn't be motivated just to win the argument. Rather, you'd be committed to staying centered in your own sage. You might think of it as a three-step process. First, the moment you feel that annoyance or triggering, that's your cue for self-command. Before you speak, you take 10 seconds for a few PQ reps. Discreetly rub two fingers together, focusing on the sensation. This quiets your survival brain and brings your sage brain, your prefrontal cortex, online. It allows you to respond instead of react.
So manage my own internal state first.
Always. Then with your sage in command, go and explore. Get curious, not furious. Instead of seeing an adversary, you might ask internally, what is he really afraid of here? What experience has led him to believe empathy is dangerous? What is he trying to protect? This shifts him from a caricature villain into a complex human being operating from his own saboteur-led fears, which after all makes him exactly the same as the rest of us.
And the third step?
Ironically, you want to apply empathy, be motivated to understand what it's like to be in Charlie's shoes. So we're back to Stephen Covey. First, seek to understand. So that's more exploring. Ask a sage-powered question to build a bridge. You might say something like, "That's an interesting distinction you make. Could you tell me more about the damage you've seen empathy do? I'm curious to understand your experience with it." That question validates that you've listened and uses curiosity to gently probe the belief. You don't have to agree with his view, but you keep the conversation open. And most importantly, you maintain your own inner peace. You stay out of his pool and on the deck.
It strikes me that this approach is exactly what's missing in our wider public discourse. This applies everywhere, from deeply polarized communities in America or my own home in Northern Ireland, even right down to the family dinner table.
You're absolutely right. At its core, deep polarization is a mass saboteur hijacking. Entire groups get entrenched in the judge-saboteur's narrative. We are right and good, they are wrong and bad. In that state, there is no curiosity, no compassion, no creativity. It's just two highly activated survival brains trying to win.
And it's why so many families have off-limits topics at the dinner table, because everyone knows they will trigger a fight. But if just one person can practice this, if one person can stay on the deck, and instead of stating their own opinion, ask a sage-powered question like, "Help me understand what makes that so important to you," they can change the entire dynamic. It shifts the interaction from a debate, which is a war between your saboteurs and my saboteurs, to a dialogue, which is a connection between sages. So, when people say we need more empathy, what they mean is we need much, much, much more empathy. But it has to be a disciplined, courageous empathy, the kind that's strong enough to quiet our own inner demons so we can see the humanity in our perceived enemies.
We are nearing the end of our time. Emily, as our heart and soul on the podcast, I want to give you the final word. For our athletes listening right now, maybe they are driving to the pool or heading out for a run. What is the bottom line? Why should they consciously work to develop this skill of empathy?
Okay, for every athlete listening, here it is. Consciously developing empathy will fundamentally upgrade your performance and your enjoyment of your sport in five key ways. One, it supercharges your resilience. Self-empathy is the ultimate antidote to your judge. It allows you to bounce back from a bad session or race faster and stronger because you're not wasting energy fighting an internal war. Two, it optimizes your physical recovery. Empathy helps you listen to your body's signals with kindness. You'll know when to push and when to rest, preventing injury and burnout, which leads to a longer, healthier athletic career. Three, it builds unbreakable team bonds. Empathy for others is the glue that holds a training group together. That support network will literally pull you through the toughest moments of a season. Four, it makes you more coachable. When you can empathize with your coach's perspective, you see feedback not as an attack, but as a gift. This creates a high-trust relationship that accelerates your path to your goals. And finally, number five, and this is the one that brings it all together, you will connect to your own unique why. When you operate from a place of self-empathy, the choices you make all come from a place of what you truly value, not from what your judge is screaming at you to do. You might eat better, you might take longer recovery times, you might drop a race, you might even drop a coach to find one that suits your own needs. You might actually choose to work harder and challenge yourself even more. The point is that it's you doing the choosing based on what you care and value most. You shift from being driven by fear to being led by your purpose. And that is the most powerful fuel of all.
Well, this was an unexpected topic. And of course, I'm sorry for the circumstances, but I've really benefited from our deeper examination of empathy. I think I have gratitude for Charlie Kirk giving me the gift of this exploration. With your help and all the slightly different perspectives we looked at, it seems like, if anything, I've actually undervalued empathy's importance in a successful, happy, and fulfilled life. Thank you both so very much for exploring it with me. If you haven't taken a saboteur assessment to uncover your own unique saboteur profile, then please head over to mindfitathlete.com/discover and we'll set you up with an assessment invite with the option of a free 30-minute one-on-one debrief.
And if you'd like to not just learn more, but experience more, then we have a whole week working on empathy during our foundation course. Find more information about that on our website, mindfitathlete.com/foundations.
For now, from all of us here at the MindFit Athlete, thank you for listening.
Take care and happy training. I've been Scott.
And I've been Emily. Bye-bye, everyone.
Thank you for tuning in to the Mind Fit Athlete podcast. If you've enjoyed today's material and you'd like to dive deeper, our Mind Fit Athlete community is waiting for you over at mindfitathlete.com. That's where we take these insights and integrate them into our everyday lives. In fact, we're on a mission to help everyone build their mental fitness so they can choose happiness, thrive, and make a positive difference. We are building our mental fitness in sport and in life, and we'd absolutely love to have you join us.